Hello, and welcome to today's podcast from Premier, where we work every day to bring together the collective knowledge of the Premier Alliance to spread trusted insights on what works. This is your host, Brian Bowles. Today's topic, SGR reform and the implications to physicians and providers. Our guest, Blair Childs, Senior Vice President of Public Affairs at Premier. Blair, thanks for being on the program today.
Great to be here, Brian. Thanks.
So, Blair, on April 14th, the President signed into law the Medicare Access and CHIP Reauthorization Act of 2015, which permanently reforms the way Medicare pays for physician services, retiring the flawed sustainable growth rate formula, or SGR, which has been problematic year over year over the last 20 years. What do you think are the major implications of this legislation that providers need to be thinking about now? And moving forward, is everyone going to call this bill macro?
Yeah, great question. It's got macro implications, I guess is what I'd say. So we should probably call it macro. It's a watershed bill on a number of levels. One is because it does get rid of this this old SGR formula, which has created a situation where every year physicians are sort of hanging and wondering what's going to happen in terms of their pay for by Medicare, whether they were going to be cut. So it ends that phenomena and also the risk to other healthcare providers that they might be cut. And it provides a clear roadmap going forward in terms of how physicians will be paid, what they really can count on, and what they can sort of plan their future around. So it's very significant that way. But beyond that, it really sets up what has been a gradual movement in payment and incentives for physicians and other healthcare providers in Medicare to, one, it's not just staying in a fee-for-service system where you're paid for the procedures that you perform. If you perform the procedure, you have to perform it and deliver the outcomes that you need to have. You'll be measured, and you need to show that you're delivering high levels of outcomes. So this is a pay-for-performance aspect to it. So that's one part of it. The other part is that it's clearly pushing healthcare providers to think about getting into two-sided risk models where they are taking responsibility not just for the care of patients but also for doing it in a financially responsible and efficient way. So very important. This is so overwhelmingly bipartisan. It shows that there's still a lot of controversy around the Affordable Care Act, this is an area, payment reform, changing from the current fee-for-service system to a new kind of a pay-for-value system is absolutely a bipartisan commitment that exists. Some of the other important implications are this is going to really cause physicians to pay much more attention to how do they plan their future from the standpoint, do they stay in fee-for-service or do they shift to these new alternative payment models with two-sided risk? So this is where there's going to be a lot of thinking going on, a lot of education over the next few years for physicians, helping them think this through. And then I do think from the standpoint of hospitals who have been in a pay-for-performance, pay-for-value mode for the last 3 years and thinking about it for many years before that, hospitals have done much more to prepare for this this reality than the physician community has. So this is going to, I think, cause physicians to look to hospitals to work with them more collaboratively, because hospitals already have a lot of the infrastructure that you need to put into place to make this work. So hospitals are well positioned. It's going to encourage physicians to work more closely with hospitals overall, and I think it will encourage much more collaboration across the system and really potential employment by physicians with hospitals, or working, again, more collaboratively through clinically integrated networks where the physicians stay independent, but they also work more closely with the hospitals in a more coordinated, collaborative way that helps them keep the costs under control and deliver higher quality care with greater patient satisfaction. So that those are the key implications.
Yeah, Blair, it's interesting. It seems like across the country there are some markets where you see heavy activity between health systems and physicians entering into these alternative payment models like the Medicare ACO program, bundled payments and the like. And there are other markets that are completely devoid of this activity where physicians in particular are still operating in the traditional fee-for-service mindset. And do you think that, I mean, it sounds like you think that this new legislation, if the physicians understand really what's at stake, really will drive, particularly in some of those other areas where physicians haven't been engaged, to be much more engaged about how to get into how to, one, perform under the VBP rules and performance measurement that they'll be subject to, but, two, if they want to be excluded from that, how they get into these alternative payment models when they haven't already, and then who do they partner with to do so?
I think without question that'll happen. I was really struck when we had a recent meeting with our ACO collaborative members, which I think most folks realize that Premier has been at the forefront of this change, and we have the largest ACO collaborative in the nation and far and away the most sophisticated in understanding these changes. And we held our meeting a few weeks ago, and we invited some physician groups to attend who were just, you know, this was right before SGR reform passed. And it was striking because they were very unaware of all of the activity underway by large physician groups and hospital systems, health systems, to try to re-engineer care. So it was a real eye-opener for them, and it made me realize even more so that this is going to cause them to suddenly pay much more attention and do more to educate their members about what this reform means, because it does. It lays out a very clear roadmap in terms of what physicians will need to do to improve to ensure that they get paid adequately, because what happens under this reform, the macro, which has, again, macro implications. What it does is it says you can stay in fee-for-service and you'll be under a pay-for-performance, pay-for-value system. You will have a portion of your payment at risk, and if you're not an efficient, high-quality provider, you will lose money, and you have a potential upside under fee-for-service. But it will always be, you know, an at-risk on your performance, system. And or you can shift into a two-sided risk model, and you can receive a 5% payment bonus. And then in the future, if you stay in the two-sided risk model, you get a higher update every year under that model versus staying in the old fee-for-service system. So you can see that the whole system is pushing providers toward these alternative payment models, and it's really quite clear how it's doing it. And again, physicians, because they have not been exposed to this pay-for-performance system so much, they just were introduced to it this year with a pay-for-reporting program. They're just beginning to understand this, and all of their associations, which do a lot of the education of physicians, are now just, learning about this and beginning to pay attention to it in a much more meaningful way. The educational process is going to ramp up significantly, and so physicians are going to start really understanding this. They're going to start planning their futures in a much clearer way. How do they want to work with health systems? How do they want to work either independently or as an employee, or how do they want to organize overall? And these will be all decisions that I think will be being made over the next few years. And this whole new merit-based incentive payment system under fee-for-service that starts up in 2019, plus the 5% bonus program that starts up in 2019, that may sound like it's okay, it's 4 years off, but it's really not, because you're being measured on those programs starting in 2019 by your performance in 2017.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to really be thinking about this, getting the programs in place, starting them up so that you're able to be in an alternative payment model. If you want to go there in 2019, you need to start planning that right away. So this is go ahead, Brian.
So I was going to say, and I know we're going to talk a little bit about the merit-based incentive payment system, or the MIPS program, which is the value-based purchasing at-risk component for the new legislation. Interesting that the performance starts in 2017, at least in terms of the baseline measurement, really moving up the timeline, which I think people will misunderstand if they don't really get a good handle on this, thinking, oh, well, it's not till 2019. I don't need to worry about it right now. Things need to happen today for 2017 performance so that you can perform well when 2019 rolls around, because by then your data will be – the data on that performance will be basically set. Is that correct?
You nailed it. So let me just take a moment to – verbally explain the way this works, and it's complicated, but I'll try to do it as clearly as I can. So what has happened is the SGR is now gone, and you are going to replace this with a guaranteed payment update for basically 4.5 years until 2020, of 0.5% update per year for physicians. So physicians will get a small update every year under fee-for-service for the next 4.5 years until 2020. And then after that, there's a pay freeze for fee-for-service. So physicians that stay in fee-for-service will have a pay freeze for the next 5 years until 2025. And then after that, the physicians get a 0.25% payment update per year from 2026 and on. And then what happens is that there's a number of pay for reporting programs. So there's the PQRS program, Physician Quality Reporting System. The physicians started having to report their quality measures in 2015, this year, starting in January, or they faced a 1.5% Medicare payment penalty. And frankly, only about half of the physicians in the country have been physicians and other providers, other eligible providers, because there's other nurse practitioners, others that are eligible under this system. Only about half of them have been submitting these measures, and so a lot of people have received penalties. There's also meaningful use penalties that are underway. And so all those programs continue for the next 4.5 years until 2019. And then they are replaced by this new pay-for-performance simplified system that puts 4% of their pay at risk, and then 5% in 2021, 7%, and then in 2022 and beyond, 9%. So it ramps up the amount of pay that's at risk. You can lose 4%, then 5%, then 7%, depending on if you're a poor performer. And you can gain, much more, 9% or more. You can actually receive a bonus payment beyond that. So if you are a super efficient, super high quality, super low cost physician, you can actually receive under this program a bonus payment that will go to a very, very small number of physicians. I mean, it'll be very small, but if you're a highly efficient physician, you could get a big bonus payment. So that exists under fee-for-service. And again, in 2019, this alternative payment model program starts up, and that's the 5% bonus that physicians can and other eligible clinicians could get. 5% bonus a year, so instead of a pay freeze, you could get a paid bonus of 5% for 5 years, up until 2025. So we've got a chart that explains this. You can look at all these to help you understand how it rolls out. And if you stay in an alternative payment model, instead of a 0.25% payment update starting in 2026, you get a 0.75% payment update in 2026 and beyond. So you get a payment differential, and over time that'll grow, obviously, because every year it'll be an additional update that's higher under these alternative payment models than if you stay in fee-for-service. So it's complicated, but to your point, Brian, that's the way it rolls out over this time period. But the measurement is delayed. So you're measured in the prior years for when your pay is impacted. So you're paid in 2019 based on your performance in 2017. So if you're getting into one of these merit-based incentive payment programs, your performance and the way you're incented under the MIPS program or under the alternative payment model will be based on your performance in prior periods of time. And so that all becomes part of what you need to plan and think about when you're planning your future from the standpoint of what payment track you want to go into.
Yeah, it seems like in the MIPS program, there are some pretty big swings from the maximum negative to the maximum positive that folks can get a handle on based on their performance versus in the alternative payment model, which if you meet those thresholds, you become excluded from that MIPS program, get your 5% bonus, and then whatever shared savings or dollars you might achieve based on whatever that alternative payment program is that you're participating in, like a bundled payment or the Medicare ACO or in the future years with commercial payers. So with the APMs, being able to get that bonus and whatever you can achieve within that payment model, but the thing that goes along with that is being excluded from this performance measurement in the MIPS program, which probably will be attractive to many physicians and really does illustrate sort of the carrot and the stick model where, really there are penalties on one side versus trying to push providers and organizations to those alternative payment models, because that's how we know the government sees the costs being shifted down over time, and they really see that as the mechanism to do so based on the results they've seen in all their demonstration projects and other innovation projects like MSSP, BPCI, CPCI, et cetera.
Brian, you just made three very critical points. So first is there is bipartisan, bicameral support for this. So Republicans, Democrats, all want to move from the current fee-for-service system to a pay-for-value system. So there should never be any question in people's minds about that. This is the direction we're going. It's unequivocal. Everybody needs to pay attention to and think about how are they performing to the different measures and how are they measuring themselves and so forth, and are they paying attention to that? So that's point one. Point two is, Your point about the delta between the amount that you have at risk and the amount that you could gain from a bonus is very significant. A physician that is in a high-cost area could lose and who is not performing at the highest level, and a lot of it has to do with the same measures that are going to be incentivizing folks under fee-for-service will be the key to success under these alternative payment models. The delta is 9%. It grows to 9% with a 5% bonus. So it's 14% of your Medicare payment. So you could lose 9% and you could gain 5% with the difference being as much as 14%. So a physician, that's obviously a significant dollar amount overall that you need to think through from their standpoint. And then the last thing that you said, which was a third really critical point, is we have found from all of our work with our members on these alternative payment models, bundle payment, Medicare Shared Savings Program, patient-centered medical home, there are innovations that people can put into place, that healthcare providers can put into place, that actually achieve much higher efficiency and a much lower cost, that affords providers the opportunity to share in savings and improve their margins, not actually lose money, but they can actually do better financially by actually helping to keep costs under control. So our members who are in, for instance, the demonstration project on bundled payment, which the way that works is it's you're measured 3 days before a hospital stay, the hospital stay, and 90 days after the patient leaves the hospital for specific conditions, such as a hip or knee replacement or a cardiovascular procedure or a spine procedure, very specific conditions that a patient comes to the hospital to have done. And by better managing the way the care is delivered, our members are achieving, on Medicare payment, very significant payment savings. They're actually reducing the cost very significantly by re-engineering the care process. Better working with the patient, better preparing the patient for the procedure, better managing post-acute care costs, better assuring that the patient doesn't readmit. All these different things that actually will be incentivized under the measurement programs, under MIPS, but by doing it in an alternative payment model, the physicians are able to share in savings plus get the 5% bonus. So there's a lot of potential opportunity here, and these are the calculations and the thought processes people, physicians, hospital systems need to be thinking through and should be thinking about how do we collaborate across these different provider groups that have been heretofore in silos, post-acute care in one silo, the hospital in another silo, physicians in another silo. How do we work in a more collaborative way to re-engineer the care process, achieve savings, and keep costs under control, and at the same time, earn the incentives that are built into this system?
Yeah, Blair, one of the things that really strikes me about all of this is if I'm a hospital or a health system and maybe I haven't done as much on the ACO physician alignment front thus far, I need to have a really strong value proposition for the independent physicians in my market to join these sorts of alternative payment models with me collaboratively, because, I mean, even if you look at the Medicare Shared Savings programs that are out there today, half of them are physician-led versus hospital health system-led types of ACOs. So if I'm a hospital health system, I probably need to have a very definitive and thought-through strategy for physician alignment because of this, and a strong value proposition of about why to do this collaboratively with, you know, me, the hospital health system, versus self-organizing or going it alone. Do you see that as one of the key things that hospital health systems are going to need to be thinking about over the next year or so?
Yeah, I think if you've listened to all of the things that we've been talking about here, physicians are going to be educated and paying much, much closer attention to all these pay-per-value opportunities and risks that they face. So that's a reality that's going to be out there in the marketplace in a way that it's never been in the marketplace before. That's point one. Point two is there are a lot of organizations that are looking to say, you know, you don't need to work with others, just use physicians, work with us. And as these will be companies that will be starting up, startups, say, work with us. We're going to organize a better system for you to make more money and succeed under these alternative payment models by working with us, and don't work with the hospital, don't work with anybody else, just work as a group of physicians. And so there's going to be a lot more competition in the marketplace as because of this, potentially, with these organizations. And we already know they're out there. There's a variety of them, and they're all trying to organize. Just as you said, half of the ACOs in the country are actually organized by physicians. So they're competing basically with hospital-run ACOs. And in some ways, our view is that at Premier is that our goal should be to lift the bar for everybody. It shouldn't be that providers should be competing with one another to hurt one group or the other. It really needs to be to how do we lift the bar overall. So we're trying not to move to a system where where we have warring factions among providers, but rather get greater collaboration. So in those companies like, you know, Universal American and Remedy or SMG, they're going to basically be looking to sort of organize the physicians more at the expense of others in the healthcare system. And you know, I think so that is a reality. That's the second point. The third point is I would argue that hospitals do have more experience and infrastructure and positioning in their community to organize with providers, with physicians and other healthcare, other clinicians, nurse practitioners, et cetera, who are eligible for the SGR payment system. And so I do think everyone's been thinking about this and they've been doing this on the hospital side, but they may not have taken the steps to organize with the physician community, the clinician community, as effectively as they might. And if they haven't, they really need to step into high gear on this because the clinician community is going to want this. And they're going to either go to the hospital organization or they're going to go to one of these other organizations that's seeking to organize the providers separately and to sort of, you know, put them at odds with hospital systems at their, you know, organizing them at their own expense. So that is, frankly, a market reality that exists that people should be thinking about.
Yeah, I think that's really important in, you know, being able to have a definitive value proposition and a roadmap for getting into these alternative payment models, maybe in less mature markets, so that providers and physicians will have a comfort level of doing that. I think it gives them a little bit of safety there, too, when they see a plan in place that they can get involved with rather than trying to build from scratch. You know, Blair, the other sort of indirect implication of this that I've seen, you know, if I'm a CIO and I understand what this means from a physician engagement standpoint, you know, I really think this is only going to compound the data interoperability challenges that we've seen across the market, that now you'll have more organizations trying to come together. They're all on disparate HIT systems. If you're trying to do population management using that data that is in the ambulatory setting, in the acute setting, the data integration needs, if I'm a CIO, just become much more real and apparent for me that I'm going to have to deal with. And I know there's some language in the bill related to interoperability for EHRs and the like, but, you know, there's a lot of data flying around that now become, you know, probably will be needed to come together much more quickly than previously maybe thought, particularly with your independent physicians in these types of clinically integrated networks, if they really are going to be coming together under these alternative payment models. So I see that as sort of an indirect reality. And if I'm a CIO, that's an implication for them as they think about this reform that they probably won't see manifest for a little while. But again, having a strong data integration strategy will be important as you start to operationalize the population health management capabilities to operate in these alternative payment models, and the things like being in a quality certified data registers, QCDR, that's recommended in the legislation as well, to be able to submit those measures and the like. But I think from a population management perspective in the pop health IT space, the data integration needs just become much more real if I'm a CIO having to deal with, because of these providers, more of these providers coming together more quickly than maybe we thought they would. But now they're more engaged and they're now on 20 different IT systems that I've got to figure out how to bring together one way or the other. So, you know, that's one area that I see as a real implication from an IT standpoint that maybe wasn't, you know, sort of, I think it's more of an indirect one, but one that's going to be very real for the practical, tangible work that has to get done over the next few years as they stand up a population health operation to participate in these things with their eligible providers.
Beautifully stated. Two major points there. The IT infrastructure required here is challenging. And so to succeed in an alternative payment model in particular. So And because you need to be able to look at how are patients moving through the healthcare system, where are their costs, where could there be greater efficiencies and so forth. And understanding all of that data is very challenging. So this is, again, where I do think hospitals and health systems which have better IT infrastructures have a better long-term position that they can work off of within this new emerging reality. Yeah. Second thing
Go ahead, sorry.
Well, the second thing is that, so I do think it's a huge challenge. It's a very significant issue, and it's something that people could be, sold something by somebody talking about how they can easily do population health data management for them, which really won't work and could put them at risk. So I think physicians, eligible clinicians for these programs need to be very thoughtful about that. The second point is that at a policy level in Washington, the number one issue when it comes to HIT is the need to fix the interoperability problem, because there's two aspects to it. One is the cost for providers, the system costs and difficulty in using it, which is extraordinary. And secondly, is that in order to keep costs down, you need to be able to see where are the patients going. You need to be able to prevent the duplicated tests and so forth, which can be achieved by having the flow of data between providers made more easy. And right now it's very difficult, as everybody knows. And so this is really a high priority. I think policymakers in Washington realize that the incentives in the system have actually created monopoly situations for the EHR vendors, which have actually enabled them to harm providers, and slow the movement towards interoperability. So the pressure is now to try to move these EHR vendors to open their systems, make them more interoperable. And so you're going to see a lot of change in this area over the coming years.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And the one other, I guess, indirect implication that I think people need to be thinking of as a hospital health system, they want to be the provider of choice in their community. They want to be the place people want to go and providers and physicians want to work with. Now, in these alternative payment models, if I'm a physician, I want to be very mindful of which hospitals I work with, because in these alternative payment models, of course, the hospital stays are the most expensive areas of cost to a large degree. I need to be, as a hospital, an efficient, low-cost provider that I can demonstrate to physicians and payers, because if I'm a physician, I don't necessarily want to get involved with a high-cost organization, because I'm not going to be able to, well, one, I guess there's a good opportunity for shared savings maybe, but that makes it a lot harder to achieve the certain types of results you're trying to achieve. And I want to be, I don't know if I want to get involved with a high-cost provider. I'm looking for the lower-cost hospital health systems in my market. Would you say, is that an accurate representation of that, or how do you think of that sort of cost containment aspect of the hospital health system side when they're thinking about these alternative payment models and the value proposition for the physicians?
No question, Brian, that all the players in the system will be looking at who are their best partners. And the best partners will be decided by, who is the best prepared for this change that's occurring, who's got a strategy that makes sense to them, and who is working to really, as I said before, raise the bar for the system overall in their communities, so that physicians, other eligible provisions, clinicians, nurse practitioners, clinical nurse specialists, or registered nurse anesthetists, physician assistants, all of those individuals are they're brought in. The bar is raised for everybody. So thinking about how you build a better community health system and putting together a holistic strategy, that is what organizations will be thinking about As you said, it's almost like the provider of choice, and there's a provider of choice for the consumer in the market. There's a provider of choice now for the other providers in the market. Who do you want to collaborate with as you build out your systems and who you work with the most closely? Because you'll have choices, and there's going to be better ones than others, and the better ones will do better financially under these models. There will be very clear incentives that will incentivize you to work with the better performers.
Mm-hmm. No, I totally agree with that. I think that's exactly right. And it really will be around, you know, a lot of that differentiation in the market and really positioning themselves collaboratively as the provider of choice with the employers in their community, with the commercial payers in their community, and with the patients in their community, to be able to be successful within all of this. And it does require all the elements we're talking about. And you know, the new legislation here giving hopefully a burning platform for physicians to really shift into this alternative payment model world, because we do know that is how cost containment is going to happen over the long term, which is what this country needs to be able to sustain and to solve the sort of the healthcare spending problem that has plagued the budget for years and years that we've been dealing with. So Blair, I know we've talked about a lot of issues. Really appreciate your time thus far. What would you leave for our listeners here as, you know, really what should they be doing now? What are the things that are kind of immediate that people should be considering or assessing about themselves to get themselves prepared around about all the implications we've talked about today?
Well, I think there's a few things here that are clear. I guess let me just try to tick them off. Point one is, spend the time to understand this macro legislation and understanding the timeline and the way things work in the system overall. Secondly, I think everybody's at a different place in their preparation. So whether you are a physician organization or whether you are a hospital, standalone hospital, or whether you're a health system, you're at different places in your capability and organizational structure. And understanding the macro environment, this significant push to alternative payment models, and this world of measurement, this world of collecting measures, reporting measures, and then performing to those higher levels of performance based on where the rest of the country is, understanding how you're going to compete in that world is critical. And then based on where you are and what your capabilities are, have a very clear roadmap. This is where developing a defined, well-structured, understandable strategy so that you can then help communicate that to other healthcare providers in your community about where you want to fit within the system becomes a very important process. I would urge everybody listening to this to make this a priority over the next 6 months, literally, to put into place a process to develop that you're thinking in this area and your strategy. And it's important to see how all of this is unfolding, what the timeline is. This legislation creates a very, very clear timeline. And by 2019, you have this choice. You can go to these alternative payment models and get the bonus, or if you're already in those alternative payment models, you'll be able to get the bonuses. But you have to have certain amounts of your Medicare payment going through those alternative payment models. So there's hurdles to get over. There's steps that you need to take to get to the point where you can achieve that alternative payment model. So figuring out where you are, where you want to be, how you want to play, what your strategy is, how you're going to succeed in all of this is essential to be thinking about right now and having a process in place to build yourself, because there is a clear timeline. You may not make it by 2019, or you may make it by 2019. But my encouragement would be, let's find a way to earn the 5% bonus, also earn the other opportunities that you can gain from being more efficient and innovating the way care is delivered in your area, because there is a potential upside because of duplicated tests, because of inefficiencies in the system, because of poor handoffs between one provider and another provider, because of using less than the optimal provider. So these are all things that people need to be thinking through, planning and organizing, terribly complex. And I think, again, hospitals and health systems are better positioned overall because they have the strategic infrastructure in place to do that thinking. But it's a lot to go through and to measure out. And you know, this is what Premier is working with our members to achieve. We have been differentiated in our ability to help our members succeed in this environment. And we look forward to working with all of our members to succeed in this environment, because it's a wonderful opportunity and it's a wonderful risk, or a high risk. I shouldn't say a wonderful risk, a very significant risk. And, you know, our success in helping our members manage through this has been a clear differentiator. We perform better under value-based purchasing than other healthcare providers. Our members do that participate with Premier. Our members do better under the ACO models than everybody else in the country. And we will do better under the bundled payment programs, which are still in the early stages. But I suspect we will do better because we have more efficient ways to help our members succeed. So we look forward to continue to work with our members to take advantage of the opportunities here and to minimize the risks as this all unfolds.
Yeah, there's a lot of work ahead for folks, but it is certainly exciting times to be in healthcare and really be on the leading edge of how all this is going to come together and work. So, Blair, thank you so much for being on the program today. I mean, what a great asset to have really the smartest man in D.C. on healthcare policy that there is to be on the team and available for the members as a resource to understand these implications. Just thank you so much. I know our listeners appreciate your insights, and we really look forward to having you on again as the legislative environment really evolves over the next couple of years. So thank you so much.
Great. Thanks, Brian.
I would also like to thank all of our listeners. We hope you enjoyed the program today. Do you have ideas or topics that you'd be interested in hearing about, or are you a provider that has a story to tell? Please let us know. Please reach out to us with your ideas at population_health@premierinc.com with your ideas. We really appreciate your suggestions, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.